Kenya is still reeling from Tuesday's protests and riots in Nairobi. But what were they all about?
All other preceding generations, every move they make is determined by fear. This is the generation that will end that fear so that we can give life to the Constitution. The Constitution is not just a toilet paper.
Plus, Hamas is building new weapons factories in Gaza.
Hamas is setting up small-scale weapons manufacturing sites throughout the Gaza Strip, is recruiting additional young men in areas of the Gaza Strip that Israeli forces are not currently operating in, and is thus creating this regeneration structure.
And later, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine visits the front lines, and a look back at Russian atrocities in another post-Soviet republic. Today is Wednesday, June 26th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Kenyans woke up to the acrid smell of tear gas still lingering in the capital a day after protesters stormed parliament amid violent demonstrations over a controversial tax plan during which at least 23 people were killed. As Wednesday began, there were no reports of violence. Police and soldiers patrolled the streets as city workers began cleaning up debris. Parliament, the City Hall, and the Supreme Court were cordoned off with crime scene tape. The military was deployed overnight to support police. Kenyan President William Ruto said on Wednesday that he will not be signing the controversial tax hike bill into law. In an address to the nation, Ruto said his decision to withdraw the legislation came after reflecting on the content of the bill and listening to the protesters. Protests over the proposed tax increases turned violent in Nairobi Tuesday as demonstrators clashed outside parliament with police who fired live ammunition after attempts to disperse the crowds with tear gas and rubber bullets failed. What's different about these protests is that young Kenyans, mostly members of Generation Z, born roughly between 1997 and 2012, have been leading the charge against the bill and the government. And it's giving political protests in Kenya a new face. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
Raha Mweni and Clarence Kiragu join other protesters for a demonstration in the streets of Nairobi.
I am unstoppable!
We cannot be intimidated, they sing. These young adults say they have taken to the streets to call for the withdrawal of a bill to raise taxes, which they say is punitive.
They're taxing everything that's essential to us. You even have people from everywhere, middle class, upper class, we're all here to protest against this bill. So that should show you the gravity of this situation. Shouldn't the aim of the government be to improve the standards of living?
Unlike previous political protests in Kenya, these protests are largely led by members of Generation Z, people born in the late 1990s and early 2000s. They are largely using social media to mobilize. Kiragu says their tactics have been successful.
We're using social media as a platform to show them that we cannot be contained. They want us here until 6, we'll protest until 8, we'll protest until midnight. In all platforms, we'll be here to tell them that that finance bill needs to go. Reject the finance bill.
Socio-political protests in Kenya have, in the past, largely been led by politicians and their supporters without the involvement of young people.
Reject.
Chief Nyamweya, another protester, says his generation's motivations are different.
We have been governed by fear since independence. All other preceding generations, every move they make is determined by fear. This is the generation that will end that fear so that we can give life to the Constitution. The Constitution is not just a toilet paper.
Kenyan police fired when demonstrators stormed the legislature Tuesday. Reports say at least 5 were killed and dozens injured or arrested. Kiragu says the brutality of the police will not deter them.
Yeah, Gen Z are the ones leading and they know that, but they are still deploying their police officers, tear gassing people like it's a normal day activity. That's definitely wrong.
Kenyan President William Ruto said the tax debate had been, quote, hijacked by dangerous people. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
As the unrest was unfolding on the streets of Nairobi on Tuesday and the parliament building was set on fire, the first group of Kenyan troops arrived in Haiti to keep the peace. It all begs the question, if they can't keep their own capital safe, what are they doing thousands of kilometers away? Fiona Joins of Reuters takes a look.
These are the first Kenyan police officers deployed to tackle gang violence in Haiti. This contingent of a long-awaited Kenyan-led peacekeeping force arrived in the Caribbean country on Tuesday. Haitian Prime Minister Garry Conille promised that, little by little, control of the country would be regained.
The state will regain power and reaffirm its authority so all Haitians can live peacefully in this country.
Kenya's National Security Advisor Monica Juma said the force would prioritise protecting civilians, opening up routes for movement of people, goods and humanitarian aid, and protecting state institutions.
People of Haiti deserve peace, deserve security, deserve sustainable development.
Gang wars in Haiti have now displaced 500,000 people. Nearly 5 million are facing severe food insecurity. Armed groups, which now control most of the capital, have formed a broad alliance while carrying out widespread killings, ransom kidnappings and sexual violence. However, even as uniformed Kenya police disembarked from a Kenya Airways plane in Port-au-Prince, a different kind of chaos was erupting back in Nairobi. Kenyan police opened fire on anti-tax demonstrators who were attempting to storm parliament. Several protesters were killed and dozens wounded. A Kenyan security source said the Nairobi violence was unlikely to disrupt plans to send more Kenyan police to Haiti. It has, however, led to some questions about Kenya's ability to lead the security mission.
That's Fiona Jones of Reuters reporting for us today. And now our coverage of Israel and Gaza begins in Washington, where Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant met with U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin on Tuesday, a day after receiving a warning from Secretary of State Antony Blinken against allowing the conflict with Hamas in Gaza to expand. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Concern growing Tuesday as increased shelling at the Israel-Lebanon border raises the prospect of a broader regional conflict. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant continued his Washington meetings, joining Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin at the Pentagon, who called for a diplomatic solution.
Hezbollah's provocations threaten to drag the Israeli and Lebanese people into a war that they do not want. Such a war would be a catastrophe for Lebanon, and it would be devastating for innocent Israeli and Lebanese civilians.
Gallant said Israel was at a crossroads that would impact the entire Middle East.
In the north, we are determined to establish security, changing reality on the ground, and bringing our communities safely back home.
Israel has rejected Hamas's demand that a temporary ceasefire in the 8-month-old conflict would result in the end of the war. One analyst told VOA that Gallant is a key link for the United States as it continues those negotiations. Raphael Cohen is the director of the Strategy and Doctrine Program at RAND Project Air Force.
The Biden administration has generally seen Defense Minister Gallant as a actual ally in this endeavor. Gallant of note sort of offered his own post-war plan several months ago. It wasn't bought off by the Netanyahu administration. So I think Secretary Austin and Secretary Blinken believe that they have some sort of willing partner in Gallant that could be a sort of useful intermediary with the Netanyahu government.
The war began October 7th when Hamas launched a surprise attack on Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking some 240 people hostage. Gaza's health ministry, which does not distinguish civilians from combatants, says more than 37,000 Palestinians have died since the beginning of hostilities. At the United Nations Tuesday, humanitarian affairs officer Yasmina Guerda warned that the situation in Gaza is dire.
None of them have living conditions. What they have, if you look closely, is survival conditions. And barely. They're holding on by a thread.
The U.S. State Department said Tuesday many land aid convoys in Gaza are not reaching civilians due to criminal targeting. Matthew Miller is the spokesperson for the U.S. State Department.
The work remains ongoing. The situation is still incredibly dire. We need to continue to get more humanitarian assistance into the north and, of course, address the stagnation and, in some cases, the reversal in situation in the south.
Miller said an end to the conflict is the only reliable way to end the suffering in Gaza. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Hamas is rebuilding its weapons production capacity in the Gaza Strip as part of a larger effort to reconstitute its military forces. An Israeli military correspondent reported on June 24th that Hamas is establishing small weapons manufacturing sites across Gaza in order to replenish its stockpiles of military equipment and weapons. For more, I speak with Andy Parry. She's a Middle East Security Program researcher with the Institute for the Study of War.
We are seeing reports that Hamas is reconstituting its military forces in the Gaza Strip. Reconstitution has two main components. One side is the reorganization of forces by combining degraded units into like these more cohesive and capable fighting structures. And Hamas has presumably been shifting and reorganizing its forces throughout the war as the IDF has moved in and withdrawn from different areas of the Gaza Strip. But now what we are really seeing is this other side, which is regeneration. Regeneration consists of replenishing depleted stocks of weapons, training and recruiting new forces. And most recently, we've seen a correspondent working with closely with the Israel Defense Forces saying that Hamas is setting up small scale weapons manufacturing sites throughout the Gaza Strip, is recruiting additional young men in areas of the Gaza Strip that Israeli forces are not currently operating in, and is thus creating this regeneration structure.
Now, Hamas, the Palestinian Authority, different UN organizations, different NGOs, all say that Gaza is nearly totally destroyed, totally devastated. There is no safe place. How are they able to manufacture weapons and carry out this sort of organizational structure in any kind of meaningful way?
Absolutely. Well, one of the questions we have to ask is where Hamas is getting this raw explosive material from. And a lot of it is coming from unexploded ordnance or bombs that Israelis have been dropping on the Gaza Strip. Israeli officials estimate that there's upwards of 3,000 bombs that have not exploded. And Hamas and other Palestinian militias have been able to gather these materials and rig them to detonate, to target Israeli forces. There's reporting that Hamas is creating these sites where Israeli forces are not currently operating. So they're able to really complicate how Israeli forces are targeting the new sites.
Now, Benjamin Netanyahu's one of his stated goals is to eradicate Hamas. If this is correct, it certainly looks like that's not going well.
The Israeli political and military establishment has definitely been increasingly clear on what their war aims are in the Gaza Strip and how they define the destruction and dismantlement of Hamas. They're going after leadership, after Hamas's underground infrastructure, diminishing Hamas's total like body of knowledge and their ability to fight as a cohesive unit. They're not expecting to kill every single Hamas fighter out there. They ultimately want to make sure that October 7th can never happen again. And by really degrading Hamas's ability to fight as a cohesive unit, they're making sure that that can happen.
I think some people might have in their mind a munitions factory, you know, kind of like what we think of, you know, from the newsreel footage of World War II, the arsenal of democracy and big weapons rolling off the assembly line. What kind of facilities are we actually talking about here when we talk about a manufacturing facility?
These all indications is that these are small facilities with just perhaps a rocket lathe or just quite small scale. This contrasts to what the IDF has been able to destroy throughout the Gaza Strip and what Hamas was previously able to use and organize to manufacture its weapons that it's using right now and that it used during the assault on October 7th. So we're not talking about a huge manufacturing site, but Hamas is continuing to build up its stores that it can use now and in the future against Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip.
If you know about these facilities, Presumably the IDF does too. I would think they would attack them, no?
Absolutely. I think they are continuing to go after weapons production experts and these facilities. But while they know about some of them, it can be tough to get all of them that are popping up, especially if they are these small scale and well hidden sites.
We'll leave it there for today. Andy Parry is a Middle East Security Program researcher at the Institute for the Study of War. Ms. Parry, thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. As we begin today's coverage of Ukraine and the Russian invasion, the memories of Russian interference in another post-Soviet republic are still fresh. That story coming up. Now, on to Kyiv. On Wednesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited troops in the Donetsk region, and more on the arrest warrants for top Russian military officials. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
On Wednesday morning, President Volodymyr Zelensky posted a video address from the city of Pokrovsk in the Donetsk region. This area is currently the scene of some of the fiercest fighting in the entire front line.
Почав цей день на Донеччині разом з нашими воїнами, разом з головкомом сирським та новим командувачем.
Zelensky announced that he arrived in the Donetsk region together with the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, Oleksandr Sirsky, and the newly appointed commander of the joint forces, Andriy Gnatov. The president officially introduced Gnatov to military personnel and listened to the reports directly from the combat positions. Zelensky held a meeting on the security situation in the region and discussed further actions to be taken by the Ukrainian armed forces with the commander-in-chief and the brigade commanders. The president also honored the soldiers with state awards. Zelensky also visited a field hospital that is a stabilization point for wounded soldiers. He talked to the medical team and honored them with state awards as well. Other important issues addressed during the visit were the security and assistance to the local residents. The president said ensuring the essentials of life such as water, social issues, evacuation, assistance for defense, and the restoration of housing is currently a priority. As reported on Tuesday's show, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for former Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and Chief of the General Staff of the Russian Armed Forces Valery Gerasimov for shelling Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Previously, arrest warrants were issued to the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the authorized representative of the President of the Russian Federation on Children's Rights, Maria Lvova-Belova, for the illegal deportation and transfer of children from the occupied regions of Ukraine to the Russian Federation.
Є нові ордери від Міжнародного кримінального суду щодо російських вбивць.
President Zelensky welcomed such a decision of the International Criminal Court and said that Russian officials should be held accountable for what they are doing in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukraine returned 90 more prisoners of war from Russia in a prisoner exchange. Among the soldiers returned home to Ukraine are defenders of Mariupol and defenders of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Also those who were captured in Kherson, Donetsk, Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, and Luhansk regions. Ukrainian military officials confirmed that as part of the latest prisoner exchange, Metropolitan Ionofan of the Russian Church representation in Ukraine, who was under arrest in Ukraine for supporting Russian armed aggression, was exchanged for Ukrainian soldiers. According to the General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, Ionofan agreed to his exchange in April 2024. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And from Ukraine, we head to the southeast. Campaigners in Georgia are working to highlight past atrocities committed by invading Russian troops during the 1990s and 2000s, which they say should have acted as a warning of the dangers that Moscow posed to Ukraine ahead of Russia's invasion there in 2022. The campaign seeks to highlight the suffering of forgotten Georgian victims through a documentary and series of events in Western capitals. VOA's Henry Ridgewell has more.
As the Soviet Union was collapsing in the early 1990s, Georgia declared independence. there were tensions with ethnic minority groups in the Abkhazia and South Ossetia regions bordering Russia. Many Georgians say Moscow exploited those tensions to stoke conflict. Tamar Chergoleshvili, the founder of the Before Bucha Was Abkhazia campaign, blames Russia for the war.
Wars broke out in Georgia that were branded as ethnic conflicts and civil war, but in fact it was Russia that was organizing all those turmoils, wars and bloodsheds in order to dismember Georgia and not to allow newly independent states to become truly independent, truly sovereign and become the member of the Western democratic world.
Russia disputes that history and insists it sent troops into those regions as peacekeepers. In the conflict between separatists and Georgians from 1989 to 1994, an estimated 10,000 to 30,000 people were killed. Exact figures aren't known, and over 200,000 were forced to flee their homes. Survivors of the conflict say multiple atrocities were committed by local armed separatists, other militia groups, and their Russian allies. Taliko Zarandia recalls the killing of her neighbor's son. Zarandia says a group of militants arrived and charged at them like wolves. They rushed towards the boy and asked how old he was. He replied that he was 15. "You deserve 15 bullets then," they replied. Then, she says, they shot him 15 times in the head. Russia denies committing atrocities, but the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe describes what happened in Abkhazia as ethnic cleansing. The harrowing testimony of survivors is reminiscent of the accounts from Ukrainians following Russia's February 2022 full-scale invasion. In the Ukrainian cities of Bucha and Irpin, survivors describe similar killings, rapes and torture, also denied by Russia despite widespread evidence and mass graves. Chergoleshvili says Ukrainian journalists contacted her for information on what had happened in Georgia.
We all knew that something horrible had happened in Abkhazia, but it was so dusty. No one wanted to go through it ever again. But Ukrainians like made me to go through the material before giving them, and I had goosebumps and I felt so shameful.
The campaign, which is touring the United States and Europe, includes documentary screenings and presentations detailing the horrors that happened in Georgia.
To remind the world and ourselves about forgotten victims from Georgia that suffered the same aggression that Russia is using now against Ukraine, to warn the West that if they don't stop Russia in Ukraine now, they will have to spend 100 times more, like in another 30 years.
Russia invaded Georgia again in 2008. It still occupies 20% of Georgian territory, including Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Many Georgians say their fate should have provided ample warning of the dangers posed by Russia long before its invasion of Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Tbilisi.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.